Hello, and welcome to the Small Business University audio series. This series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of teaching small business owners how to run profitable companies. Each presentation features a different national speaker or business owner sharing dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. This presentation is a continuation of our series of Tim Paulson's presentation on collections. Now, you'll remember in part one, Tim talked about collection standards, collection letters, and how he dealt with some of the typical excuses that we've all heard before. During this follow-up presentation, part two, Tim will cover the proper use of the telephone, the obscene collections caller, and some very effective negotiating tips that you can put right to work. Now, let's get started. This is part two of effective collections techniques.
In this section of the program, we're going to cover techniques and, in particular, the right attitude to have when you're speaking to a customer or debtor who has lost it. They may be irritable, upset, perhaps even obscene. It's the type of situation when you call them up, make an introduction, perhaps a calm statement for your money. Maybe they question the legality of your parents' marriage. They may even let you know where you can put that return check of theirs in no uncertain terms. Now, these calls almost always take us by surprise, and we might be thinking, hey, I just told them who I was, why I was calling. There's no reason, you may figure, for them to have lost their temper. Well, there's always a reason. We may not know what the reason is, may not be able to do anything about it, even if we did know, but there's almost always a reason. A basic concept of TA, transactional analysis, tells us that it's almost okay, it's almost socially acceptable to lose your temper over a certain period of time over a particular number of incidents. Now, you might be the third person to have called the customer that day about a past due bill. Remember the competition I talked about earlier. They may have gotten a speeding ticket on the way into work that morning. Perhaps he found out the day before his kids have joined a religious organization that he's never even heard of. And maybe, for the last 15, 20 years of his marriage, the customer's wife has been treating him like a Greek god, placing a burnt offering before him every evening when he comes home for dinner. Now, all of these situations he may have handled in a cool, calm, rational adult manner, and then you call up, and away he goes. Because now he's going to let loose and kick the cat, and you are the cat. What can you do in a situation like this? Well, this is another opportunity where you can pause the program, list down a few alternatives, and compare them with the ones I'm going to suggest to you. First of all, you'll want to keep in mind that there isn't a single response that's going to work each and every time. An approach that may work well one day, even with the same customer, may not work with him or her 3 months from now. Here are a few approaches that you may want to consider, depending upon your business and your own style. First of all, you could ask them to stop. Mrs. Smith, I don't appreciate that sort of language, and I just want to deal with your account as best as we can. Number two, lower your voice. You may even want to whisper. Ever have anybody come up and they whisper something to you and we ask them in a whisper, why are you whispering? When you lower your voice, it does a couple of things. First of all, there's the mimic aspect that we tend to do. And second of all, they're going to be trying to listen to see if maybe you're using a few words back at them that may get you into trouble a little bit later on. Third option, you could terminate the call, offer to call them back. Could be something along the lines of, we don't appear to be getting anywhere right now, Mrs. Smith. How about we terminate this call right now and I call you back in 5 minutes? Now, if you say you're going to give them 5 minutes, I suggest that you give them at least that, maybe even a little bit longer. Because bear in mind, they went to kick the cat, and you moved the cat. You call them back too soon, they might be sitting right by the phone, wanting to get back, give you a couple more shots. You could let them go. Let them carry on. When they finish, just carry on your conversation just as if you haven't heard anything at all. You could transfer the call, give it to somebody else. Could be a supervisor, maybe a manager, co-worker. But you ever notice sometimes when you do that, they come back to you and say something along the lines of, they sounded okay to me. Well, the odds are they weren't talking to the same person that you were. Now, there are some credit criminals out there. Some people who not only get up on the wrong side of the bed that morning, they've been getting up on the wrong side of the bed their entire lives. But most of the folks we deal with, it's not their best behavior, and they know it. You give them someone else to talk to. It gives them a chance to take a bit of a deep breath, become the better part of themselves. They won't use the same sort of language. They might complain about you, but they won't use the same sort of language when they do. Now, you can use that same technique without making the transfer. Something like the following. Mrs. Coltrane, it sounds as though you're very upset. Please tell me, have I done anything personally to get you upset? Because if I have, I'll apologize for it. I want to be able to work with you on this account as best as I can. Now, as I mentioned before, nothing works all of the time, but it gives them that opportunity to take a deep breath, come back, the better part of themselves, and you may be able to carry on with the conversation. Okay, we've talked about some options, some things you may want to do, and I suggest you keep in mind the acronym Q-tips. Quit taking it personally. The odds are whatever they're saying has nothing to do with you as an individual. Eleanor Roosevelt said, "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent." Nobody can hurt your feelings. You decide whether your feelings are going to be hurt or not. Now, it's easier said than done. I understand that. We've talked about some alternatives, some things that you may want to do. Let's talk about some options that I suggest you avoid. First of all, if they should tell you what their problem is, don't say, "I understand how you feel." I worked on a youth line in Toronto for about a year, and one of the things they taught us when you're talking to the kids is you don't say, "I understand how you feel." Now, I could be talking to some youngster whose grandmother passed away the week before, and maybe my grandmother passed away not that long ago, and the temptation is to say, "I understand how you feel." Well, I understand how I feel based on my relationship with my grandmother. I don't understand how they feel. So some folks, you tell them you understand, they're going to be more upset than they would have been before. And number two, now you know what we really want to do with this type of call. We're professionals, but we're people too, and when somebody gets our backs up, we want to come back and say, "You too. End the horse you rode it on." There was one company I worked with. I went out and bought my collection team one of those knockdown type sort of dolls, you know, the sort of thing you put up and it stands up on its own. You give it a punch, down it goes, comes back up again. And I told them, you know, don't take your aggression out on the customers that you're dealing with. Come over and punch the particular, I think it was Popeye that we had sitting up there. Well, I found I had to take it out after just about a couple of hours. It didn't work at all. They punched Popeye and it didn't reduce their aggression. It increased their aggression. They wanted to get back on the phone and tell them exactly what they really thought of them. Now, they didn't tell that customer. They told the next one that called in. Not so much in words, but in tone of voice. Now, these calls are not fun, but they do provide us with an opportunity. Now, it's just like the U.S. Army advertisements used to say, to be the very best that you can be. Anyone can handle the easy calls, but it takes a controlled professional to handle a customer who has really lost it. Thomas Jefferson said, "The biggest advantage you can have over someone is to remain cool and unruffled under any circumstance." I developed and led a program for a government group quite some time ago, and one of the things they were concerned about was the type of calls they would be getting because overpayments on social assistance and parking tickets and so on. So they knew that they were going to be dealing with a lot of people who were irate. These were new people to the business. They were concerned about these calls, but by the time we finished the training, they were looking forward to them. Because they're fun to get? No, but because it gives you the opportunity to be the very best that you can be. So please remember, in our business, the motto may very well be cool, calm, and collected. Subject I'm going to be talking about here is one of your most important tools in the collection business and one that most people haven't paid any attention to at all. If you keep a saw in your garage or down in your basement, the odds are you probably keep it sharp. Keep your car tuned. You may even make sure that your cell phone is charged and ready to take and make those calls. But one of the most important tools that we have in our business that most people ignore is our telephone voice. Most people will speak on the telephone and they'll use the same voice that they would use if they were sitting directly across from an individual. And most times that's a mistake. Because when we're sitting directly across from people, a lot more communications takes place with body language. What we do with our body, our eyes, our expressions, the voice isn't quite as important. But on the telephone, you don't have anything like that going for you, so the voice is more important. Do you remember the first time you heard your own voice on a tape recorder? Odds are you shook your head and you said, "No, that's not my voice. I don't sound like that." But if someone else was listening to it and it was a quality enough recording, they'd recognize your voice. They'd say, "Yeah, that's the way that you sound." Think for a moment. Anybody that does the anchor news on television, male or female, few of them speak in their normal voice. They have developed and they use a special broadcast voice. Now, that voice tends to be lower, louder, clearer, They'll enunciate their words a bit more. They'll pause a bit more often. There'll be a few of you out there who will remember Walter Cronkite used to be on CBS News. Just a master at it. Walter would pause not only after sentences, but sometimes after syllables. But you never misunderstood what he said, and that voice compelled you to listen to it. Even Ted Baxter on the old Mary Tyler Moore Show, now he might mispronounce a few words, but you understood his mispronunciation exactly. Now how can you make your voice perhaps a little bit better? Well, you could take a course somewhere, you could get a recorder, hear how your voice sounds, alter it, work on it that way. There's an easier method, but I recommend the privacy of your bedroom for this. Because I know my youngest son, I'm not the respected authority father figure to him I could have been if he hadn't caught me doing this a few years ago. You get yourself a book or a magazine, read aloud in your normal conversational voice, and then you take one finger and you put it in one ear. Close off that sound. Continue to read. Now you can hear how you sound to other people. This is where you lower your voice. Speak a bit lower, a bit clearer. When the voice sounds right, you can take your finger out. Continue to read in that voice. Now you only need to do it for 5 minutes. Do it once a day. Over 5-7 days, you'll have that special voice that you can turn on off just about any time that you want. I recommend you'd want to use it on two occasions. One, any time that you're on the telephone. Two, should you be called upon to speak in front of a group of people, it's the sort of voice that you would want to use. Now, I know that there are some people who are the pride of their collection outfit, even though they speak in a Mickey Mouse voice at the pace of an Uzi machine gun. But my suggestion is they're not successful because of their voice, but in spite of it. And if they had and used that special collection voice, they would be more successful yet. Are all of your customers the same? I'm sure you'd agree there are quite a few differences. People in different backgrounds, work environment, professions, and cultures are going to have different values. They are different, and that makes the world a more interesting place, and our challenges and receivables much more interesting, too. Not too long ago, I taught a series of programs in China. Now, in China, many other parts of the world, they approach business and relationships different than we do in North America. Now, it's not better, and it's not worse, but it is different. Now, how might this apply to your business? Well, for example, let's say your business is commercial collections, where you have to collect from other firms. Some of the people you have to deal with could range from accounts payable personnel to accountants to the owner of a small business, perhaps even the chief executive officer. Different positions, different responsibilities. The way they look at the world is not the same, and they do not have the same values. Now, if that's the case, I think you would agree that it makes sense to modify our approach. Now, there was an assertive young woman in one of my seminars who said that she believed all of her customers should be treated the same. Now, in response, I asked the folks in the seminar how many of them had more than one child. A group of people put up their hands. I asked if the children were all the same or if they wanted to motivate them to do something, did they find they often used a different approach? Now, they all nodded their heads, and if you have more than one child, I expect you might agree as well. We do need to treat all of our customers fairly, giving them the same discounts and opportunities that we may provide for others. But our approach need not, and indeed should not, be the same. Now, if your business is consumer collections, where you deal with just about every type of profession, let's say from a construction worker to a lawyer, police officer, even a minister, you will find that what may motivate a lawyer to bring an account up to date is not the same as a teacher at a local high school. Now, I don't suggest early on in a consumer conversation you say something like, "Excuse me, Mr. Trombley, but could you please tell me what type of work that you do so I can pull out my psychological profile?" However, perhaps prior to the conversation or from something that is said during the call, you'll either know or you'll have a pretty good indication of what they do to make a living. Now, do you need to use psychology in collecting? Only if you want to get paid quicker and still keep your customers. There is some work involved in developing a profile and the particular approach that you're going to use, but it will pay off handsomely for you and your firm. Here's a suggested assignment for you. Number one, list down the different types of professions that you have to deal with. Now, if you're in a consumer environment, you may have quite a few, so start with a top 10. For example, if I was to ask you the question, which are the ones that present the most challenges to you, who would be on that particular list? Maybe add a few to it later on. Don't spend too much time on folks that appear to not present any particular problems to you. Two, take one of them and develop a profile. Let's say you deal with accounts payable as an example. And you have to deal with accountants. If you were required to describe what a typical accountant is like, what would you say? Now, this is where it's handy if you got a group to use a brainstorming technique. Go for quantity, don't worry about quality. Anything that comes to your mind should go down on the list. Afterwards, when you run out of ideas, maybe you review the list, alter, change a few things on there. I'm going to give you an example of this a little bit later on after I tell you about a couple of the next steps. 3. Based on what we believe we know about this type of individual, how might we alter our approach? What things may motivate them to pay, provide information? 4. Use the altered techniques that you have come up with. And then 5. Improve and continue to add to your list. Now, you may be thinking that all accountants are not the same, and you're right. Now, accountants typically thought of as a fun bunch of folks that you invite to your party to liven things up. No, they're not. However, having said that, Ray, a friend of mine, is an accountant and one of the funniest people I know, but he is not a typical accountant. Your tailored approach may not be perfect with every person within a profession, but it will be better than a general approach treating everyone the same. Now, earlier I promised you an example, so I'll give you one from the commercial side of the collection business. If you deal with and collect from other companies, I suggest you don't collect from Nordic Frabistet as an example. You collect from an accounts payable clerk at Nordic Frabistet. Or it could be an accounts payable manager and owner and so on. Never a company, always an individual. Here are a few things from my list of what I know, believe I know, about accounts payable clerks. 1, they have no authority to sign a check. They're very busy at different times of the week, the month, the year. They can bury you if they don't like you. They're going to follow orders, be it cash management or otherwise. Now, how to tailor your approach? I'm going to ask them what I can do to make their life easier. Are we sending them the right information? Is it in the right format? Do they need more? Do they need less? If I need to contact them, is it better at a particular time of the day? Do they have certain days of the week, the month, when they're real busy and calls just aren't going to get through, just going to make their life a little bit tougher? Would they prefer to have faxes or perhaps email? If they have a policy to follow, for example, paying in 60 days when our terms are 30, who is the best person for me to speak to? Now, I may do a little bit of the how's your mammy, how's your pappy type sort of thing, talking about the weather, some interest they have, but only when warranted and providing they're the type of person who seems to enjoy that sort of thing and they have the time to do it. Now, the process I've described is used by all of the best collectors in the business. They will alter their approach based on their experience. What I've described just takes this process a little bit further, allowing even a seasoned collector to do what they do well, better, and to share that information with others in the company. The philosopher Santayana said, if we do not learn from our mistakes, we are condemned to repeat them. Now, I'll add to that a little bit and suggest if we do not learn from our success, we don't have the opportunity to repeat that success. Thinking through our customers, identifying and altering our approach will help us to learn from any mistakes and to repeat our success. Now, I found that garage sales are quite popular all across much of North America. I like to go to garage sales, and so does my wife, Donna. Now, I'm going to tell you something about Donna, and this is just between you and me. Donna is not the best negotiator in the world. We're walking up a driveway. There's a table on it, has some product, gentleman standing behind it. Maybe there's a lamp on there with a price tag of $20. Donna looks at him and says, wow, $20. I've been looking for a lamp just like that one. I would have given you $30 for that. She takes her money out, pays her $20, starts walking down the driveway. Now, out of three people, now Donna's walking down that driveway, and I've told her she reminds me of the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. All I can see is that smile going down that driveway. She's going down the driveway, the gentleman standing behind the table with $20 in his hand, and then there's me standing there. Out of the three, how many do you think are happy? Now, some people say two, but I suggest one, and perhaps not the one that you might think. The only person happy is Donna, going down the driveway with the product that she wanted at a price she was willing to pay. She knows she could have gotten a better deal if she negotiated, but she doesn't like to do it. It's not fun for her, and that's fine. Now, I'm not happy because I know at a garage sale, $20 does not mean $20. It means let's talk. It could depend upon the time of day, what the weather's like, whether I'm buying some other products that could be there. I can get a better price than $20. A lot of folks think the seller might be happy standing behind that table, $20 in his hand. But bear in mind, someone said, I would have given you 30. And if that wasn't bad enough, his wife standing up on the veranda behind him saying, I told you so. Effective negotiating is when both parties are going to be satisfied. Now, this segment on negotiations is important for collections, but useful in many other areas of your business and perhaps even your personal life. Think you might be interested in attending a program in your city with the very best negotiators in the world and it won't cost you any money? Well, I'll tell you, they're so good you may not even know who they are. Who are they? Little, it's almost Munchkin City, little kids about 5, 6 years old. It's almost as though Mother Nature said, look, I'm going to make you a deal. You're going to be small for a while, but I'll give you some advantages over the big folk. Give you these big round eyes, maybe a little waddle, innocent look. The advanced one have that lower lip quiver that they seem to be able to turn on and off just about any time they want. And Mother Nature says, if that wasn't enough, I'm going to give you some negotiating techniques that will knock their socks off. Something like the following is taking place around the world. The details will change, but it's happening all over, and I've seen it in many, many places. First snowstorm in my hometown of Toronto comes about November sometime. But no matter when it comes, there's going to be a mom or dad somewhere who's going to be taken by surprise. They're going to be rushing around, getting snow shovels and all the sort of stuff they have to do to get themselves ready. Mom's going to be hopping across the kitchen floor, trying to get her boots on, and between her third and her fourth hop, she's going to hear this little voice of an angel behind her saying something like, Mom, I need, and you can fill in the blanks from there. I need $5 for this, or sign my report card, or to do something. And Mom's going to turn around and look at them and say, why are you asking me now? Spent quality time with them the night before, whichever, and they're going to look at Mom with these big wide eyes and say, I forgot. Well, did they forget? Well, I'm not suggesting that they're so Machiavellian that they sat there and watched Mom and said, ah, I didn't know about the snow, did you, Mom? Nah. Okay, well, wait till she gets to about her third or fourth hop. It isn't quite like that. They know Mom's about to be out the door. They're getting a little confused. They're not quite sure what to do. Mom's going to be gone. Mother Nature leans down to one of those pristine, soapy little ears and says, now. And in they come like a Scud missile. Now, Scud missile, you don't have to get a direct hit. Close enough is close enough. Odds are they get what they want or much more closer to it than they would have gotten if they'd talked to Mom the night before. Now, what does Mom do? Gets into her parental pose. Now, don't you think you find it a little bit scary? Find out we're using some of the same body language, words, vocal inflections that our parents used to use. Mom gets into her parental pose and says, now, next time, bring this up when we've got time to talk about it. Now, the little negotiator is going to look up with these big wide eyes and say, okay. But will they? Not a chance. Even if they wanted to, Mother Nature is going to stop them and say, not now. She'd know that you're there to have time to negotiate, and perhaps even worse, tell the child how tough it was when you were that age. Now, we can't win the war. We're outgunned. But you may have a few more success in some battles if you know about some effective negotiating techniques and to be able to use those techniques on some of the big folk that you have to deal with in your world. You may not have kids of your own, but you're going to have nieces, nephews, kids in the neighborhood. When negotiations are taking place, pay attention. Mother Nature is giving you a lesson, maybe for free. There's some special techniques I'm going to share with you on negotiating for collections. First, negotiating techniques for collections is the golden rule. Now, you know this. It isn't new. Zoroaster taught it to his followers in Persia. A long time ago, Buddha preached it on the banks of the holy Ganges. And Jesus Christ taught it in the stony hills of Judea. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And when should you do this? All of the time. How would you feel if you and your company were in a difficult position? How would you like to be treated? That could happen to any of us. You may have to make some difficult decisions in the collection field, but the objective is to handle those choices and those conversations in a calm, professional manner. Now, by the way, there was a gal at one of my seminars at an electrical power company who asked me if I was going to cover anything that day on how she could make some difficult decisions, for example, having to cancel a service to a customer, one who might be trying their best but just couldn't meet the requirements, and how she was going to feel about it afterwards. She kept feeling bad. Was I going to cover anything she wouldn't feel badly? And I told her I didn't know how to do that, and if I did know, I wouldn't cover it anyway. I think we are going to make some difficult decisions, and we are supposed to feel bad about them. It shows we're still people, maybe doing a job that's difficult on occasions, but still people nonetheless. If it ever gets to the point where you can make some of these decisions and it doesn't bother you in the least, well, maybe you've been in the collection business just too long. Once you know that there are some difficult decisions and that you're supposed to feel badly about them, they won't bother you as long, they won't bother you as deeply. Number two, know yourself, your assumptions, and your beliefs. Before you begin any negotiations concerning collections, it's helpful to know a little bit more about yourself. And I suggest best way to do that is to ask yourself a few questions. Do you believe that people and companies should pay their bills on time as agreed? Now, I suggest yes, we do. We entered into an agreement. We expect people that are going to pay them as best as they possibly can. Leading us into B, is it our responsibility to be willing to be flexible in certain situations? Yes. Now, once again, we're not talking about some credit criminals that may be out there, but most folks, when they signed up with us in whatever sort of format we have for credit, it was not their intention not to pay us. So, yes, we're willing to be flexible in certain situations. C, should you treat the money that you're trying to collect as if it was your money? Now, the surprising answer I have for many collectors is my answer is no. You're better off to treat it like a game. You know what a game is? A game is you care, but not that much. Because think about it, if you really treated it like it was your money, you're not going home that night. Or you're going to take that work home with you, either physically or mentally. A professional, you do the very best job that you can, but then you walk out of the office at the end of the day, whatever your quitting time happens to be, and leave it behind you. Now, it's a bit of a contradiction, but if someone owed you money, I suggest that I could do a better job of collecting that money than you could, and if someone owed me money, you could collect that money better than I would. Next one. How serious are you going to take a customer who tells you in no uncertain terms to take a hike, take that long walk off that short pier? Now, I suggest the answer is take them seriously, but don't take them personally. There are a lot of people who have found or believe there are certain tactics will be successful for them in negotiating. It doesn't have to work that way with you. Do you have the personality that a debtor can relate to? How flexible can you be? We've heard that opposites attract, but most of the time that's just not true. It can often help if you can mirror some of the debtor's personality in order to perform negotiations better. Next question, will you be willing to do the research that's necessary? Everything has a price. Sometimes it's low, sometimes it's high. In order to be prepared to be successful in negotiations, there may be a fair amount of work that has to be performed. Are you willing to pay the price? Now, there's not a big price involved if you're just looking for how much you're going to pay for a pound or two of apples, potatoes, or something at the store. But if you're going out to buy a new car, I'd suggest there's a fair amount of research you may want to do. Next question is, how much fun do you find negotiating? Now, if you don't find negotiating fun, I suggest you don't want to stay in the business of accounts receivable, because that's what we do. You might as well have some fun at it. How well do you know your opponent? In North America, before a weekly sporting event, the coach, the assistants for a football team, will have reviewed the film, studied in detail their opponents for the following week. Now, you'll want to do the same for your customers. Perhaps not in every case. After all, a football team will only have to be playing once a week. You may have dozens, if not hundreds, of customers to deal with in a single day. But just because you can't do a lot doesn't mean that you shouldn't do a little. Now, this ties in a little bit with the types of customers that we were talking about before. Same sort of thing in negotiations. Who you're going to be negotiating with, knowing more about them, will allow you to be much more successful. In the next section, I suggest that you plan your strategy, be flexible, including walking away if negotiations are going to fail. This comes back to ensuring that you have specific objectives before you enter into discussions. Your minimum acceptance will also let you know when it is time to disengage from those negotiations, report to higher levels within their company or yours, take some other action. Next important part in negotiation skills is don't be bashful. Ask for what you are looking for. When appropriate within your negotiations, ensure you've asked for what you believe to be a fair commitment from the customer. Now, once again, this starts to come back to objectives, what we talked about just a bit earlier. But it also requires perhaps practice in determining and then using the methods which you find are going to be successful for you. In this point number six, in negotiating skills, I want to talk about listening. Question for you, do you think that we are good listeners in our business of accounts receivable? Well, I think most of us are good talkers, not necessarily good listeners. I've sat with a lot of collectors, and I have found the most intelligent of us are not good listeners. After all, we've heard most of the things that they've said before. Customer starts to tell us something, and mentally, we go down the road and we wait for them. And when they get there, we tell them what we were going to tell them anyway. Now, most of the time, we're right, but not all the time. I found sometimes we're missing out on some important information. So listening, and it's not just hearing, it's listening hard, it's taking some notes. See if, as well, if you can put it into their words what the customer wants and see if they can agree to show you at least understand their particular point of view. Now, it doesn't mean that you agree with them, just that you understand what their point of view is. Now, this can also prevent someone from restating their point of view time and time again because they think that you haven't heard them. And it'll give you a clearer understanding of the customer's point of view. When you have a good relationship with a customer, you may ask them if they might try this technique from your end. Have them state what you're looking for and why. Now, it clears up communications and everybody knows that we've taken the opportunity to listen to each other. You ever found sometimes when somebody's negotiating with you, it could be a boss, a parent, a significant other, spouse, somebody, when they say, look, you can take it or leave it. Or maybe somebody says, look, you can have option A, you can have option B. People are always going to try to limit what your options are. Well, if there's an A, there's a B, there's a D, there's a C, there's a number 47. There are always choices to make. In North America, we speak at an average rate of about maybe 250 words a minute. But most people listen, think, at about 1,200 words a minute. Now, if you can get the customer talking, it allows you the opportunity to think quicker and determine what your response or approach is going to be. John, please tell me how you came up with the decision that there were only options A or B. Did you consider anything else? Or what was the process that got you to this particular amount being the take-it-or-leave-it option? Let them start talking, you think, and you come back with the response that's going to work well for you. It's important in negotiation under this point number 8 to consider and watch for your timing. Now, it may include the day of the week and even the time of the day. You don't want to negotiate when you're tired, you're in too much of a hurry. Now, you may be thinking in collections if you've got customers that you're dealing with all day trying to collect from, you can't always manage when you're going to be negotiating. But you may find that there are certain types of customers or certain balances that you know it's going to be important. Maybe those you can alter and deal with them when you're going to be at your best. So when is the best time for you? For this point number 9 in negotiation skills, I suggest you don't want to be a Butinsky. And let me explain. Some of the large retail organizations, their credit card departments are clients of mine, and I've found that some of their customers will call them up and suggest that their interest rates are rather high. Some of their people want to come back and say, but, and then give the customer a reason as to why the interest rates are what they are. My suggestion to them was to come back to the customer and say, yes, you are right. If you're interested in some of the reasons why our interest rates are what they are, it'd be my pleasure to explain it to you. If you might like to know some things you may want to consider to be able to save yourself some money, I can share those with you as well. Because if a customer is looking at a particular statement that says 28.5% versus another statement that says 11% or some introductory rate that could even be lower, are you going to convince them that that rate of 28.5 isn't higher? Of course not. When you say but, some customers, people across the table from you in negotiations are thinking, you didn't hear me. So wherever you can, agree with them. Offer your explanation afterwards. In this last suggestion, point number 10 in negotiations, we're going to talk about your opponent's position being unreasonable. Perhaps they phone you up, they owe you $5,000, and they suggest that they should be able to pay you $50 as settlement of the account. Now, it's easy enough for us to say, no, I'm sorry, that's just not going to work, and tell them what action we're going to take if they don't pay the full amount due. But perhaps, when you have some time, use the following. Mr. Smith, I don't think that we can accept your offer as settlement of the account, but you sound like you're a reasonable, sincere individual, and I'd like to hear your reasons why. Please tell me why you think our company should accept a payment of $50 on your $5,000 account that you had agreed that you were going to pay us in particular terms, whatever those terms happen to be. Now, a couple of things happen here. Number one, maybe they provide you with some information that may be useful. And number two, if nothing else, you've taken the time to listen to them. There's going to be occasions when a customer calls you with an offer of payment. Now, it could be in response to a previous conversation, perhaps a letter, something else. But let's say whatever that offer is, had you called them and worked out this particular payment arrangement, it would have been acceptable to you. So they phone you, they make you an offer, and the odds are you're probably going to say, okay. But I found that most times when people are making an offer, it's not the best that they can do. They can almost always do better than that. There's a firm that I've dealt with. They have thousands of customers, and a large number of them are past due each and every month. They don't send out a letter requesting payment. What they send out is a disconnect notice. Now, this generates a lot of calls from their customers. Customer would phone up, make some sort of an offer, and their representatives were saying, okay. But with some training, I got them to review the accounts and then to make a counter offer. So maybe they come back and say something like the following. Mrs. Smith, I appreciate what you're offering us today, but I'm not sure we can accept that amount. And there should be a pause. Something that's almost uncomfortable to the collector, and it will certainly be uncomfortable to the debtor, the customer as well. One of my hobbies is tap dancing, and I took a tap dancing class with a master one time, a gentleman named Bill Orleski here in Toronto. And Bill taught us that it's not just the sounds that you make, it's the sounds that you don't make. So as important as the words, the phrases, our voice in collection, sometimes what's important too are the things that we don't say, the pauses. So you pause. Come back with a counteroffer. So let's say the customer has phoned up and they've offered you $500 on a $1,000 account. You might come back and say, I appreciate your offer, Mrs. Smith, but I'm not sure we can accept that $500 today. Instead of that, how about the following? With your payment of $750, and then you can work out the other details from there. Any time that I've consulted with customers, they've implemented this approach. 60% of the time, the customer comes back and says, yes, they can do that. 20% of the time, they say, no, I'm sorry, what I offered you is the best that I can do. But bear in mind, it wasn't a bad offer anyway. The other 20% of the time, they say, no, I can't do that. But they come back and they give an offer that's higher than their first one, maybe lower than your second one. Now, as opposed to just taking messages, you're collecting. There was a time when I used to call this the grapefruit approach. Have you ever noticed that you can always get one more spoonful of juice from the grapefruit? There was a young gal that spoke up in one of my programs and said, that's not the grapefruit approach, she said. That's the Scotty and Captain Kirk method. She was talking about Star Trek. Now, you may not be a Trekkie or even a Star Trek fan, but there's two things that Captain Kirk often used to say to the engineer Scotty. One of them was, beam me up, or some sort of a variation of that. And the other one was, more power. Scotty, we need more power. Now, Scotty never came back and said, aye, Captain, and turned up the power. Scotty said, we canna do it. We canna do it, Captain. The lithium crystals would no handle it. It was always some sort of reason as to why they couldn't get more power. But by gosh, they always did. You want to keep this technique in mind when you're dealing with your customers. Maybe put up a picture of Scotty and Captain Kirk in the office. Maybe you can find some little USS Enterprise that's stuck in a toy box somewhere, just sitting there forlornly, not doing anything at all. Stick it up in your office, something to remind you of the particular technique that you can use. Someone can almost always do better than what that first offer is.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each presentation. Please feel free to give us a call with your comments. The Small Business University audio series is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, please give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Or check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com. Until next time, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.